and welcome to Niaga Spotlight with me, Tamina Kausji. Niaga Spotlight goes through the week in business and future affairs. Market Watch, industries, analysis and insight, we've got you covered right here on Niaga Spotlight. Well, today on future affairs, we take a very in-depth look at Malaysia's healthcare burden, particularly when it comes to NCDs. So we're going to be talking all things health economics. Now, some brand new data shows a disturbing trend of an estimated 100,000 Malaysians having passed away prematurely in 2022, owing all to NCDs. Now, NCDs, we actually spent an average rough 10 billion ringgit on it annually. And this is, of course, deeply concerning. So to get the discussion kick-started, we have joining me in the studios Dr. Milton Lum, who is a consultant obstetrician and gynecologist, as well as Dr. Teo Aini, who is a nutrition and public health research associate with Khazanah Research Institute, KRI. Very good morning. Thank you so much for making time. How are the both of you today?
Fine, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, fantastic. Dr. Lum, if I could get started off by also asking you to elaborate a little bit more about an issue that you have been advocating for a very long time. You have written a lot of editorial articles on this, connected to, of course, the NHFS, or the National Health Financing Scheme. Now, what are your thoughts on this as perhaps anchoring what could be Malaysia's healthcare industry in the future, and why does it need to be done sooner rather than later?
Well, the National Healthcare Financing Scheme has been talked about for almost half a century.
All right, 50 years, and 50 we're a country years. Going on 70.
Yeah, and the initial studies were done in the 1980s, and there have been several studies done by several consultants commissioned by various governments that we have had, but so far nothing has been done about it. The problem, as I see it, is lack of political will and leadership. Mm-hmm. Politicians think in 5-year cycles, now even shorter than 5-year cycles.
That's right, especially what we've seen since 2018.
Since 2018, yes, it's much shorter. So when you look at the national health expenditure, it's going up and up. And the out-of-pocket payments by individual members of the public is also substantial. The financing of healthcare in Malaysia at the rate it's going is clearly unsustainable. Mm-hmm. There will have to come a time when it is at a cliff where it might there will be deterioration in the services or compromise in the safety and quality of care. Mm. Some of which is already happening.
Absolutely. And I think I want to pick up on that point, especially Dr. Lum, considering the fact that whatever it is, Malaysia, like all other countries globally, we've been through hopefully the worst of the COVID-19 pandemic. We were able to see many of those gaps, especially for funding within healthcare, exposed, particularly in what is now considered to be somewhat of an endemic period. So one thing that really comes up is the ability to pay, or the ATP gaps for the rakyat, considering increased cost of living burdens. So any thoughts on that? And also the fact that superstructures from politics to the healthcare system has to be cognizant of the fact that a ringgit today is not worth what a ringgit used to be worth even 4 or 5 years ago.
Well, the ability to pay is still okay with the middle class, but is increasingly biting the lower middle class.
Sure.
Particularly when they seek private care. But if someone has, or some member of one's family has a catastrophic illness, something like heart attack, cancer, stroke, then there are studies from the University of Malaya which indicate that families or individuals face financial ruin. And this is certainly not what we want in our country. Mm-hmm. So the ability to pay depends on whether one is seeking private or public care.
Sure.
Public care is nominally cheap, but the payer is the taxpayer. And the taxpayer comes from you and I.
That's right, exactly. And I think definitely if you're looking at it on a scale, as someone who also has elderly parents who do avail of public as well as semi-private facilities, we've definitely noticed the burden go up and up, especially in the past 12 to 18 months. Thank you very much for that, Dr. Lam. Now, Aini, moving into, of course, looking at the budget 2024 parameters, MOH or Ministry of Health received an impressive 13.5 percentile raise of allocation. That's a 41.2 billion allocation. What are, however, some arguments in favor of actually allocating even more towards the Ministry of Health? 5% of GDP at least, and why is this somewhat of a golden figure that we ought to strive for?
The 5% of target of health spend, public health spending, to be specific, public health spending relative to GDP is actually necessary for us to maintain universal health coverage and public health care system. Universal health coverage refers to all peoples have the access to a full range of essential and quality health services when they need it without going through financial hardships. As Dr. Lam rightly pointed out, Malaysia's public health expenditure has stagnated over the past decade. Just to some figures, in 2021, Malaysia spent 5.1% of GDP on health in total, and over slightly over half of it was spent on public healthcare expenditures. And with the rising, as you point out previously, the continued rise in NCDs and population aging, there's an increasing cost of healthcare. At the same time, we have seen many news about the chronic underinvestment of public healthcare, and this is associated and it is reflected in some of the shortfalls in health outcomes and health system performances, such as overcrowding, low quality of care, long waiting times, and also many issues among the healthcare personnel. So in order for Malaysia to continue providing universal health coverage to our populations at a public healthcare system, it's certain that Malaysia will need to increase our public health expenditure to 5% of GDP for the entire population.
Right. That absolutely makes sense, because quite often comparing Malaysia's relatively very low public healthcare costs to maybe any other countries, not just regionally but globally, the conversations amongst Malaysians or even on social media whenever the topic comes up is that we should be thankful that we pay, for example, just one ringgit for registration, etc. Right? But to stay cognizant of the fact that at the same time we can actually help close that overcrowding and ensure it doesn't happen, but it requires more budgeting. Now, going into the fact...
Can I just
interject
here?
Sure, Dr. Lam.
You know, we Malaysian aspires to be a developed country.
Absolutely.
The OECD countries expend about 8 to 10% of their GDP on health. Now, for us, we are spending much, much less than that. And I've been told that if we are to spend 5% of our GDP of health, the health budget for 2024 will have to be double. So, of course, health cannot take everything in the budget.
Naturally.
So there has to be a plan by the government to make a graduated increase in the percentage of GDP that goes to health, public health care. Maybe an increase of 1% every year or something like that.
So that we at least reach those double figures, hopefully, right? Great. Thank you for that, Dr. Lam. Aini, if I could also then ask you to expand upon what recommendations are there then for reframing healthcare as investment for the rakyat's future, especially when we're looking at social and economic well-being and how they are fundamentally interlinked. It's not just about, for example, having hospitals available, doctors available when someone falls sick, right?
Okay. I think if we really want to pursue seeing health as an investment rather than expenditure, we need to recognize that good health has a value. And if we look at social economic values, oftentimes with good health improvement, the social and economic values is very likely far outweigh the initial cost of investment, as you called it, the expenditure in the first place. And another perspective is that poor health has a very substantial cost, economic loss to the country. Take, for example, the estimated expenses of direct healthcare costs of managing three common NCDs in Malaysia, namely diabetes, cardiovascular diseases and cancer, together with productivity losses, is estimated to amount to 22.5 billion ringgit, which is equivalent to around 1.56% of Malaysian GDP in 2017. That was in 2017.
Oh yes, definitely the figures have changed a lot since then. In fact, actually the latest data shows we spent 4.38 billion on diabetes management alone for the calendar year 2022.
Yes. But I think the most important narrative that we should constantly push forward is that health is a fundamental human right. And the right to health is as important as the right to education, housing, food, work, and information. All these basic, food is a basic right.
Mm-hmm.
And the government has the responsibility to ensure that our people have the access to access to health, and their right to health is protected and ensured.
Definitely, and I'll go a lot deeper into the nutrition angle of it in just a little bit.
I'd like to sum up in one word.
Sure, Dr. Lam.
Health is wealth.
Mm-hmm. Health is wealth indeed. And from there, Dr. Lam, I'd like to dig deeper, because particularly speaking about access and ensuring it's equitable. So how can the Budget 2024 allocation actually, in your perspective, help to address the needs of deeply underserved communities around Malaysia? Let's focus for a little bit, shall we, on the Orang Asli in particular, which you have written a little bit about, particularly when it comes to the fact that they have a lot more impact from the ongoing shortages of personnel, as well as subpar equipment facilities.
The 2024 budget has already been allocated, so I don't think we can do anything about the 2024 budget.
Mm-hmm.
But we can certainly influence the 2025 budget. And I think the government has a duty to take care of the underserved areas in the country, not only the Orang Asli, but also the Orang Asal in Borneo, and also in the city centre itself, the people in the low-cost flats. You may have remembered a few years back, UNICEF came out with a study that found that there were malnourished and stunted children in the low-cost flats in Kuala Lumpur.
That's right.
So these are the areas that the government should focus on. And it is not just giving them monetary handouts. It's not going to make substantial difference. I think the monetary handouts should be premised on the recipients doing something for themselves. I'll give you an example.
Yes, please.
If you have a diabetic or a hypertensive person, if they're not diagnosed, there has to be some monetary incentive to go for screening, get diagnosed. If you have been diagnosed, there has to be some incentive for them to get treated and to have their diabetes or blood pressure controlled. That would be far better than just giving a monetary handout on a periodic basis and having no result at the end of the day.
Mm. Fair enough. For example, our latest stats show that roughly about 20% of the adult population in Malaysia, for example, actually does have diabetes. But one absolutely has to wonder, is that the true figure? And it really makes me think of how useful it might be if we were actually using an incentive-related model.
I think that is a true figure, because the Ministry of Health carries out this morbidity survey every decade. So this was from the 2019 survey.
That's right, correct.
1 in 5 of the population are diabetics, very high.
Mm-hmm. Very high indeed.
Half diagnosed, half undiagnosed.
Ah, there you go.
Of the diagnosed, the diabetic registry tells us only 30% control. The rest not controlled.
Burden of care definitely increases with every year, right? Mm. From there, Dr. Lam, moving into another key 2023 event for the healthcare industry, which was the nicotine delisting from the poisons list on 1st of April. What are some of the medium to long-term anticipated NCD impacts from this, especially for, let's look at just Malaysian youth first?
That delisting of the nicotine from the poisons list was a monumental bungle for which the previous minister has to be held accountable. Nicotine addiction is synonymous with vaping addiction now.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be synonymous with tobacco addiction. So the effects of nicotine delisting means that various companies can advertise, can promote and sell nicotine products. Tobacco companies can sell nicotine products. And there is no inhibition or regulation against anyone purchasing these products, including the young people of our country. The Control of Tobacco Products Act has a big error in it. It didn't list smoking devices in the Act.
Mm-hmm.
That comes under Ministry of Domestic Trade and MITI. Now, we all know that vaping products can be used not only to vape nicotine, but cannabis. So, you can have somebody producing a product which can be used for multiple purposes that will contribute to drug addiction, that will also contribute to the effects of tobacco addiction, which is the same as vaping.
Mm-hmm. So is there anything which can be done from an intervention perspective? Because ultimately, the burden once again is most likely going to fall upon primarily the public health care system.
There is a new Minister of Health. Hopefully, he just put nicotine back on the tobacco list.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't require him to go to Parliament. He just needs to sign in the Gazette, and there it is back on the nicotine list.
All right.
Whilst the regulations for the Control of Tobacco Products Act go through their various scenarios and then are put in place.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly the Ministry of Health will also have to synchronize the Act together with the Domestic Trade and MITI with regard to the nicotine, the vaping products, the devices. Because that comes under a different ministry.
Correct. So trying to harmonize that as well as not having to go to Parliament to do all of it. Thank
yes.
you. We hope that recommendation is heeded. Aini, from there, moving along. Now, of course, two of Malaysia's top three NCDs contributing to the early deaths, heart disease, cerebrovascular disease, are also closely related to lifestyle choices. That, of course, do not happen in a vacuum. Now, let's perhaps go through and break down Malaysia's health report card and where we could actually be doing a lot better.
You are right, that is a growing NCD crisis in Malaysia, and it is very closely related to poor lifestyle choices, such as sedentary lifestyle, not being active enough, poor dietary intake, such as insufficient fruit and vegetable consumption, and smoking. And Malaysia Health Report is, I would say, far from satisfactory. Obesity and overweight are prevalent among Malaysian adults and children. And anemia, which is a condition caused by the lack of iron, mm-hmm. which can be obtained from food sources, is affecting about 3 out of 10 women of reproductive age. And more concerningly, 1 in 5 children under the age of 5 are stunted. And at the same time, Malaysians' healthy behaviour, like what I mentioned just now, are lacking. And this, of course, is more than just an individual choice. This is also something that's affected by the social and environmental factors that we see in our countries. And these poor lifestyle choices does not just increase the risk of many diseases, such as NCDs, they also affect our quality of life and even mental health negatively. But the good news is these lifestyle choices are modifiable, meaning with the right actions and timely interventions, and the NCDs are preventable. So answering your question, I think there are many policy entry points that are very useful to help tackle the growing health problem we have in the country,
mm-hmm.
but we'll keep it to 3 priorities.
Sure.
So we have actually are not short of good nutrition policy in Malaysia. But the bigger challenge lies in the uptake, implementation, compliance and expansion of this nutrition policy. So firstly, we need to ensure that the nutrition policy we have are friendly and supported by the relevant stakeholders to be implemented alongside regular evaluations to identify the enabler and barriers so that we can continue to implement this and expand this to the national scale.
Mm.
And second, we need to acknowledge and actively address the broader social environmental factors that drive obesity, diabetes, and many other NCD in the countries in our nutrition policies. Meaning, we cannot keep telling people to eat healthy and be active. We need to do more than that to tackle the social environmental factors that causes them not being able to be active or eat healthy.
Mm.
And thirdly, I think it's crucial to also undertake both nutrition-specific and nutrition-sensitive strategy both at the same time
right.
to tackle malnutrition in all forms.
What does that actually mean, nutrition-sensitive versus nutrition-specific?
Nutrition-specific strategies or interventions directly target malnutrition
right.
and usually on targeted groups such as children and pregnant women. Examples are micronutrients, supplementation, breastfeeding promotion, and school feeding program. Nutrition-sensitive interventions, on the other hand, are those usually main objective is not on nutrition, but they can indirectly influence food and nutrition-related factors. And they are usually a more wider range of policy,
mm-hmm.
including healthcare, education, city planning, agriculture and food trade, social protection, and also labour.
Mm.
So some of the examples include increase the walkability of the city and
sure.
increase the access to health facility or even healthy food sources.
Fantastic. So clearly the strategies are already there and they're available. It's all about whether or not they will be recognised first and then, of course, implemented successfully.
Yes.
Dr. Lam, Aini, thanks so much for the discussion in so far. We take a short break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with Niag Spotlight. Welcome back to Niaga Spotlight, still with me, Tamina Kalji. And today, of course, we are covering the very interesting issue of health economics and Malaysia's NCD burden. Dr. Lam, so continuing the discussion, now, Aini, of course, was actually focusing on telling us a little bit more about Malaysia's health report card. Tell us more about the Malaysia Health Board, which was actually in place some time ago, and why it's actually necessary to have such mechanisms to ensure that a population is pretty well informed. Clearly, there are huge gaps that have been forming with regards to NCDs particularly.
The Health Ministry's studies on health literacy indicate that only about a third of Malaysians are health literate. So there are two-thirds that are health, not so health literate. Now, a lot of the things that can be done and should be done to get a behavior change has to be done through health promotion and health education.
Mm-hmm.
A health promotion board was established in late 1990s by an act of parliament.
Right, that's very interesting.
And the health ministry did away with the health promotion board, I think 7-8 years ago.
Now, was it because the goals or the targets had been met?
Well, not because goals and targets were met, but because they felt that the board wasn't doing what they were supposed to be doing or whatever reason. But having said that, that comes under the Minister of Health. The Minister of Health can easily give directions to the board to carry out specific tasks. Now, health education is done by a unit, not even a department in the Ministry of Health. How many messages do you get in a
one working
electronic
day.
Or print,
sure.
electronic or social media about a balanced diet, how to feed your baby, why breastfeeding is better than bottle feeding.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody tells that. Don't go and take fast food.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, of course, the attractions, the promotions are all around us all the time, right?
The challenges are from the vendors of these whatever products. But the health ministry has a duty to counter those challenges, and the messages put across has to be in language that the lay person can understand.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of scientific things are very garbled, so it has to be a very plain language.
Very true. Aini, if I could dig a little bit deeper on that, with regards to particularly looking at our NCD diabetes burden, of course, the Malaysian dietary guidelines, they do have a recommended total daily sugar intake, for example. But just so that we can be clear about it, what is it exactly, and how can people, the average person, go about their day, all the way from a small school child to those of us who work in offices, etc., to the elderly? How can we go about our day making sure that we're not exceeding our daily sugar limits, for example?
I think it starts by, of course, ensuring the public are educated in the first place, educated in the sense that they are aware about health, are interested to learn about health information, are interested and are motivated to pursue these health goals. But in our society and in many parts of the world, it's often not the case. Again, like what I mentioned just now, it cannot be an individual responsibility. Government has to be there to make sure there is an environment, a supportive environment that prompts people to make these healthier choices. For example, if you talk about sugar, the reason our sugar tax, or more precisely, the sugar sweetened beverage tax, is something that actually can disincentivize or discourage consumer from purchasing the high the beverages with high sugar content and go for the healthier options, with increasing the price on the sugar-sweetened beverages.
Absolutely. So lots of food for thought over there.
You know, sugar was subsidized by the government until very recently.
Very true.
And you are subsidizing a poison for the public.
Very plainly
the
put.
The sugar tax should have been introduced decades ago.
And perhaps to manage it from there on in.
Yeah.
Looking towards another NCD, which is not very much mentioned, particularly because we have limited data around it. Dr. Lam, let's look at long COVID and also the potential for this to be a public health NCD burden. There's brand new data that's come out from the University of Birmingham, published just this week, that shows that in the UK at least, almost 1 million patient healthcare records show about a £23 million extra bill for GP and primary care appointments, this happening 12 weeks after COVID diagnosis. Thoughts on the Malaysian ecosystem?
When COVID occurred, the UK NHS established long COVID clinics. So they have data from those long COVID clinics. And I think they, perhaps of all the countries in the world, have a very good database. We have had 5.2 million COVID cases in Malaysia. The only data that you can find in the literature on long COVID are about 700 odd cases from University of Malaya and about less than 500 cases from Port Dickson. Now we have in the Ministry of Health, National Institutes of Health.
Right.
When COVID occurred, this was a golden research opportunity for researchers or whatever they were inclined to do. And still today, we don't have data on long COVID in Malaysia. Does it occur? Many of us believe that it occurs. The definitions are not great. There's still dispute about what the definitions are. But certainly, I think for active practitioners, we would want to know what are the common symptoms, how they can be alleviated, and what are the approaches that we can take. But we don't even have that data.
So it's important to first set the parameters for data collation and then, of course, proceed from there on in.
You have to know from the data what are the patient risk factors, what are the symptoms, and how to approach it. But you don't even have the patient profiles, the risk factors. Saying that you're a senior citizen, you're a youngster, you're more likely to get it, it's just not good enough.
Exactly. Now, I just wanted to also put it out there. As for coming from long COVID, especially looking at what the burden has been, it's not only about extra expenditure and a bit more strain on the healthcare system itself. It also has to do ultimately with actually economic productivity, right?
Yes. Yes.
So any thoughts on the fact that whatever it is, governments worldwide need to be a bit more cognizant of the fact that eventually this will lead to folks being more and more disabled, less and less able to take part in their daily lives? Aini or even Dr. Lam, any thoughts on it?
You know, I call for a Royal Commission on the management of COVID. Basically so that we can learn lessons for the next pandemic.
Sure, which is definitely going to happen, most likely within a decade or so.
Yeah, that's what WHO expects.
Exactly.
Okay? Not to find fault. Okay, we had an emergency. There were a lot of unknowns. So we just want to know how it was managed. But the data that we have coming out, no Royal Commission has been established.
That's right.
The data that we have been that has come out is Malaysia has the highest per capita death rate for COVID in ASEAN, second highest in Asia. Now, if you look at health indicators, death rates indicate how well the health system has coped with a condition.
Fair, yes.
Maternal death rates, maternal mortality in 2021 was 68 per 100,000 live births. The last time we had that sort of figure was in the 1980s.
Yes.
Before COVID came along, it was running around 25, 28, somewhere around there. So we should know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Did the people die from COVID? Did they die from other incidental conditions?
Or a combination of them. Yeah.
How many of those deaths were preventable?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Lots of questions to be asked. Aini, any thoughts to have add to that?
I think I would like to add on what Dr. Lau mentioned just now about long COVID data. Just personal experience. I contracted COVID twice. And each time after I finished the quarantine or the home quarantine, I received a notification on MyCetretra to participate in a long COVID survey.
Right.
So I think that's a source for the ministry to collect long COVID data. But the problem is, of course, how many people actually are willing to participate in this? And
Can I just say something about MyCetretra?
Sure,
I think
Dr. Lam.
You are aware of some questions about the security of information on MyCetretra. And that, I think, when that happen, whatever the cause, whether it happened or not, that caused, I think, quite a loss of confidence in the application itself. I hear that from my patients.
Mm-hmm.
Because I ask them whether they key in onto MyCetretra. They say, no, I'm not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So public trust is very important. To gain trust is difficult. To lose trust, very easy.
Mm-hmm, exactly. But I am in agreement that perhaps we could be looking at available data tranches and also encouraging those to expand the data that we do have. Thank you. Aini, moving along from there and digging a little bit deeper into perspectives around the new 10-cent increase in sugar tax. So ideally speaking, how should the revenue from the sugar tax be utilized and what more is required to tackle the broader NCD-related issues just from sugar consumption?
Okay, I mentioned that just now. It's actually more precise to call it, even though it's more commonly reported as the sugar tax, it's actually more precise to call it the sugar sweetened beverage tax.
Because that's right.
It's taxing specifically on sweetened beverages.
Yes.
Only, right?
And
at the
commercially
moment.
Packed beverages that we usually find in supermarket and grocery stores. Take, for example, coffee. If you buy a canned coffee in a supermarket that has sugar level above the taxable threshold of the sugar sweetened beverage tax, it is very likely taxed, means the prices will be increased because of the tax. But if you purchase, let's say, coffee from a restaurant that is super sweet, it's untaxed. And if you purchase three mixed three-in-one coffee, that's again untaxed. So it's sugar-sweetened beverage tax. So ideally, I would think the tax revenue should be spent on promotive and preventive health-related programs, such as NCDs, screening activities, and diabetes awareness campaigns, instead of looking it for diabetes treatment and dialysis centers. But it's also very careful not to earmark this tax revenue just for specific expenditures, because the intention here is to increase the Public Health Fund, especially for the promotive and preventive health related programs, not to restricting the already very limited public health investment.
Fair enough.
The tax on sugar, sweetened products, the tax on alcohol, the tax, excise tax on tobacco should be set aside and taken out from the general consolidated fund to be allocated to the health ministry for health promotion activities.
That alone.
And nothing else. Right now, it goes into the consolidated fund. It can be used to build some highway or something like that. That's where the money goes. So that tax should be taken out and set aside for the health ministry to use for health promotion activities only.
Absolutely. Yes. I'm in agreement with that.
And I would like to also highlight that we have the sugar sweetened beverage tax. It's a good step. Step in the right direction, but that's not enough.
Not enough.
It's not a silver bullet. Diabetes is only one of the NCDs that the country is experiencing. We have many other NCDs that the health system needs to tackle. So we also at the same time need to complement the sugar sweetened beverage tax with a whole range of other comprehensive policies that also tackle the broader social and environmental determinants of health in our society in order to have a strong cumulative impact on health in total.
Exactly. And what that brings me to is just thinking of the fact that in general, most folks who spend their days within the confines of an office ecosystem, you definitely have access to, let's say, the office pantry. So what are the drinks that we have access to? What are the snacks that we have access to? What do we eat during that 9 to 5, right? So thoughts around that too. From there, Dr. Lum, let's move into the recently tabled, of course, the health white paper, June 2023. Now we're in Jan 2024. Your thoughts on it, HWP, 6 months on? What's not happened? What needs to happen?
When the idea of a health white paper was first mooted by Khairi Jamaluddin, the medical profession and other healthcare professions and civil society thought it was going to be the big thing that was going to come. And I think everyone held workshops, seminars, and presented memoranda to the committee that was assigned this task. When the current government took over, there was concerns that this might be left out because they didn't start it. But there was commitment by all the parties in the current government on healthcare and health. And they said that they will continue with it. So it was passed by Parliament in July this year. Oh, last year, sorry.
No, that's right, July last year.
Okay. Now, there are several deficiencies in the health paper, but we will not talk about that. But a health paper envisages that organizational change to effect some of the aspirations stated in the health paper. The hype has been reduced to a whimper and to now silence. Coming back to what I said earlier about politicians thinking in 5-year cycles, it wouldn't surprise me if this health paper is sent down the road to the next government.
But then again, now, if we want to achieve that stated goal, ambition of about 10 million Malaysians not being hospitalized or being healthy within the next 10 years, things had better start now.
Yeah, but you know, when I look at the people who can drive the health paper forward, I look at the health ministers. We have had 5 health ministers since 2018, you know.
That's also true, of course.
That's only 6 years, you know. Or yes. Of course, one is recycled, but nevertheless, 5 health ministers. So can we expect the health minister to drive the health paper? Can we expect the government to drive the health paper? There was no sound about the health paper in the last budget. It envisages organizational change, some of which would require acts of parliament. But even then, the health paper said this can be monitored by a committee, a task force, or a commission. The health paper has got to be more definitive about what the governance structure should be like. But be that as it may, it is the government's duty, since they tabled it, to ensure that the health paper, some starts will be made in 2024, hopefully.
Absolutely. Thanks for that, Dr. Lam. We all live in hope. And definitely stating the fact that, you know, it needs to happen sooner rather than later. Aini, perhaps let's close out the discussion by looking at the fact that, of course, Malaysians are living longer but not necessarily healthier, with roughly about the last decade or so of many Malaysians' lives spent in ill health. So what are your recommendations for ensuring that public health imperatives are also focused on the rapidly aging and elderly population and actually balancing the focus, not so much shifting it away from children, malnutrition, etc.?
Yes. I think the primary focus on children has its own significance because intervention at early stage of life can produce a lifelong health impact. But you rightly pointed it out that we also need to make sure the nutrition needs of this rapidly aging population in Malaysia needs to be taken care of for future, I would say that's current and also for future investment, because it has a significant social and economic impact. For individuals, it means spending good quality of life throughout their entire stage of lifespan. And for society, it has significant social and economic benefits. By taking care of the nutrition and health needs of the aging populations early, by preventing instead of curing the diseases, mm-hmm. can help to perhaps, for example, reducing the strain in the social support system and healthcare resources, which are already very strained at the moment.
Absolutely. Dr. Lam, Aini, thank you so very much for your core insight. It's been a very interesting discussion indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Join us again next week on Niaga Spotlight. I'm Tamina Kausji signing off for now, wishing you all a productive week ahead.